long, long time ago, once upon a time, I was in the U.S. Navy, and I part of my job as a hospital corpsman was to give hearing tests to the Marines, and I got interested in hearing loss and tinnitus way back then, before I even knew I was going to be a neuroscientist. And during that time, I really got interested in, first of all, like, you know, how could, you know, exposure to loud noise cause hearing damage, and then also, why do people seem to get tinnitus when they get hearing loss? And also, tinnitus is a really challenging problem because there's no cure and there's little to no treatment for it. Aside from, you know, proactive wear your earplugs, you know, don't expose yourself to loud noise, you know, and then like take antidepressants or listen to white noise if you end up getting tinnitus. You know, I've spoken to some people that have had really terrible tinnitus and they're heartbroken, first of all, that they get it, and then they get the second blow when they realize that the doctors really can't do anything for them to go home and cope with it, basically, is what they're told.
So how would you describe tinnitus?
Tinnitus, it really varies by person. Like, I get tinnitus if I, like, go to a loud football game. I'm a huge college football fan, and my stadium actually happens to be one of the loudest in the country at Oregon, but Oregon Ducks. And so I always wear my earplugs. But even with the earplugs, I would get tinnitus after football games because I was yelling that loud, and the sound was going through my own head, and so the earplugs actually didn't work for me. But they actually did work because it cut down a lot of the high-frequency noise in the stadium or at the, you know, at rock shows. I actually kind of prefer to wear earplugs because a lot of, like, loud rock concerts have this high-frequency component to it, and when you wear the earplugs, it cuts that down. You can actually hear the singing, and you can hear the bass a little bit better. And so I tend to actually prefer wearing earplugs when I go to shows. And the other way that I became interested in tinnitus was when I first got to graduate school, during my rotations, I worked with Dr. Mike Weir, who is a psychology professor at the University of Oregon, and he studies hearing, kind of in general, and the neural mechanisms underlying how we perceive sound. And during my first summer in Oregon, I worked on a project to investigate tinnitus in rodents. It was kind of I was interested in tinnitus, like I said, because of my military experience, but also, you know, we had tools and technologies at Oregon that I could use to investigate. But now that I'm at Lethbridge, we have these tools where we can image the brain in vivo and while an animal is actually awake and behaving. And while these experiments are extremely challenging and technical to perform, and they take, you know, lots, like weeks of setup and practice surgeries and like that kind of stuff. But my hope and dream is that I can actually get a little window implanted over the temporal cortex, the side, like just above the ear of the mouse, and you know, observe it naturally for a few weeks and then put it into a situation where it's around very loud noise and attempt to induce tinnitus in the animal and observe the brain changes that occur. We know that the brain changes happen, but we don't know how they can cause tinnitus. And so what I'm hoping to do with this new era of optogenetics and transgenics, which I can define in a moment, I can actually manipulate how those neurons are active or inactive during what I believe will be the tinnitus percept. And that way, I can help the general scientific body by offering evidence and support either for or against this hypothesis that's sort of been floating around out in the community that the remapping of the auditory cortex is what causes the tinnitus.
Now that you're at the University of Lethbridge and you're with the Canadian Center for Behavioral Neurosciences, what is it that you're trying to do with your experiments?
So you asked a moment ago about how I would know if a mouse has tinnitus. Jeremy Turner in 2007 published this paper. So all of us have a startle reflex, right? If I'm quietly sitting at the desk and you sneak up behind me and you clap your hands, I'm going to jump. And this is something that we don't really habituate to. I mean, obviously, if you keep clapping, I know you're standing there, so I'm not going to startle. But if I'm a mouse and I'm living in my shoebox cage in the animal facility and a researcher just plays a startling sound, it doesn't know when another one's going to be coming. It doesn't even really understand that it might be the researcher that's doing it. And so they'll basically flinch every time you present a startling sound. And then so what we can do is we can then play a traumatic sound at a pure tone, so like an A note or a C note, like middle C, say, on a keyboard, and play that sound at a very, very loud noise level, which hypothetically would induce tinnitus. What we could then do is if you play that startling sound to the animal, but right before it, like just 50 milliseconds before, you play a little 10-second softer beep, they don't startle. And the flip side of that coin is that if you were to play like a background noise, just like static from a TV, but you centered it on where you think their tinnitus percept is going to be, and then you put a gap right before the startling sound, the gap serves as the little cue to tell, like, to sort of warn. It's not a warning, it's too fast, it's a cue that there's going to be a startling sound. So if they hear the gap, then they don't startle. But if their tinnitus is the same as the background noise, they won't hear the gap and they'll startle more than they would otherwise. And so in a way, we can ask them, what's the sound you're hearing, basically? And we can empirically test. We can just play a whole bunch of different sounds, and we can actually narrow down like where they're most likely experiencing the tinnitus.
Can you observe that in the brain or only by behavior?
Okay, so that's an excellent question. Previously, like over the last, say, 2 decades, researchers have been using electrodes, either tungsten wire or glass that has been filled with an artificial cellular solution, so like all the salts and everything that a normal cell has inside of it. And so they'll put these electrodes into their brain and poke around and basically map out the auditory cortex, which is, in a rodent, is about 2 by 2 millimeters. It's controlled by a joystick. It's a little micromanipulator, so it can move with sub-micron precision. So, you know, thousandths of a millimeter at a time. And you can move it all the way around. And neurons are about 10 microns in diameter. And so you can basically move over 50-100 microns at a time and just sort of map out the whole brain. Or, well, not the whole brain, that would take forever. But even the auditory cortex would take 2 days. People did this in cats. For really detailed mapping of the auditory cortex, it'd take at least a day or two. So you need a team of scientists to do this. I mean, not just anyone can map the auditory cortex using electrophysiology. And so you need highly trained, skilled people to spend days. I mean, and this is like nonstop because the animal's anesthetized. And so you have to make sure the animal is as happy as it can be while it's anesthetized with its brain exposed so you can do these experiments. It's very time consuming. It's laborious. It's tiring. And what I want to do is use these new optogenetic tools at University of Lethbridge, which basically I just remove a piece of the skull, put a sterile glass cover slip over the window, and then seal it in place with like dental acrylic. And then they wake back up in a couple of days, they recover. And now I can then basically put a camera right in front of this window. And the optogenetic ability or the transgenic ability of these cells to light up, like literally light up when they fire action potentials.
What does that mean if you have these cells lighting up?
Yes. And so instead of painstakingly mapping the entire auditory cortex to then play a traumatic tone that's going to damage their hearing and then map it again, it's basically too much to ask. It's extremely difficult. It's a lot of work. It's difficult for an animal to live that long during a surgery that is taking that long. And then to have the animal recover, wait for like the tinnitus to set in and then do it again, it's too much work. And so the nice thing about using this calcium imaging, so when an action potential in a neuron fires, calcium is released in the cell. And there's these indicators that can basically light up. I mean, it's kind of, you can't see it by eye, but with sensitive cameras, you can see it. And so basically, I can observe the entire auditory cortex and take a photo, and I can actually like just play a bunch of sounds, and that takes an hour. So I'm going from days down to hours now to look at what's going on in the auditory cortex, play the traumatic sound, and then look at it again. And I can just do this over time, and I can watch the brain change into the tinnitus state and then put the animal into the startling booth and then ask it, what is the sound of your tinnitus?
And what are the conclusions that you can draw from this now?
Oh, now that's a good question. So like I said, the hypothesis is that the remapping is causing the tinnitus. And so one thing that we could do is that if we know roughly where the tinnitus is occurring, like in the brain, we could target that with gene therapies, or some people have been trying vagus nerve stimulation. So you stimulate the vagus nerve and that sort of makes your brain more plastic. And some researchers have been trying to train people to not have tinnitus, but it doesn't work that well. they've had some success, but for most people it doesn't work that well. And what my hope is that by looking at what's going on while we're, you know, giving the animal tinnitus, basically, what the actual changes are in response to the loud sound.
Now, how might you take this from the mouse model and eventually apply it to human beings and treating human beings who have tinnitus?
That's a challenge that we have to think about. But I guess my idea with all of this is that if we don't even understand how it's working in the rodent, how are we going to possibly understand how it's working in the human?
Michael, thank you very much. It sounds like you've got some pretty exciting research ahead of you.
I sure do, yes. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me.